Now, we're going to take a few minutes today. It's not going to take long to do a little bit of a sidetrack. During the break. Thank you. I have trouble talking with them in my mouth. We're going to take a little bit of a sidetrack today. It's not really a sidetrack, but now we have come across a word more than once in our studies that is grossly misunderstood in the church today. Very few people understand what the real concept is. You may, and if you do, just bear with me. But the word is tithe. Now, the problem is this. This is a transliteration. This is not an English word, really. It's really a transliteration of a Hebrew word. And a tithe means a tenth. So somewhere along the line, the majority of the church and church leaders concluded that believers should give a tenth of their earnings as a tithe. Very simple. If I make $40,000 a year, my tithe at the end of the year should come to about $4,000. But that's wrong on at least two accounts. That's not correct. That's not biblical. And here's why. Two reasons. First of all, it is true that a tithe means a tenth. However, if you read through the entire law, the word tithe is mentioned more than once with different kinds of obligations. And so if you really wanted to follow the concept of a tithe and give exactly what the Hebrews were giving, it would actually come to 23%. If you total it all up. So right away, even if they're going to rely on the Old Testament teaching, I would say, well, then you got to give 23%, which very few people do. However, you've got to remember, whereas this is instructive, it is, all Scripture is inspired by God and is profitable. And it's instructive because God doesn't change. And if he wants his people to support the work, why would he not want them to do it now? But his methodology has changed now. And so now people are using it as a verb. Did you tithe this week? It's not a verb, it's a noun. But what I'd like to look at, and this is what most people, most believers, and it's just a few verses, do not appreciate, is what is our obligation, if there is an obligation, to give back to God some of what he gave to us? How can we know how much to give him? And where should it go? These are the questions we want to answer. And the first thing is this. Not every believer, so far as God is concerned, and I'm going to try to stay away from the word tithe, I'll use the word give, should give the same amount nor the same percentage of their income. In 1 Corinthians 16:2. Now, listen what it says in 1 Corinthians 16:2. First Corinthians 16 and verse 2. it says this. On the first day of every week, each one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper. These are very important words. As he may prosper, so that no collection be made when I come. Now, basically speaking, what he was saying was, he was looking forward when he came to Corinth to receiving an offering from them. He didn't organize the faith. So he says, you put it aside. If I arrive in Corinth in 3 weeks, for the next 3 weeks, put aside what you feel. And when I come, you can just give me the whole thing. We're done with it. But the fact that he says, as you prosper, means that today, if somebody asks you what percentage should you give, the answer is you should give as you prosper. In other words, to put it in modern language, it's actually graduated. Now, you know how our income tax in the United States is graduate? Somebody who makes $20,000 a year doesn't give the same percent as somebody who makes $200,000 a year. So one of the things that you want to take into consideration is, how have I prospered this year? And based on that, what do I feel comfortable in giving? Now, it's wise, I will just mention, to give a little more than you're comfortable with. Just a little bit. Because that gives you a reliance on God. But you should not expect somebody who makes $20,000 a year to be tithing $15,000 a year. But I would be surprised if somebody making $10 million a year tithe $15,000 a year, because it's nothing to them. So it's graduated depending upon how God has prospered you during that year. The second thing that's very important is, where should the tithes go? And in Malachi 3:10, there's something that's very instructive. And I'm saying this is how it should work. And here's where we get a little bollocked up. In Malachi 3:10, it says, bring the whole tithe. Notice they're using that word tithe, but it really represents that whole 23%, into the storehouse, so that there may be food in my house, and test me thou in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open to you the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until it overflows. And the main thing here is, he's saying, to bring it into the storehouse. In modern language, that would mean that what we're to do Malachi 3, what did I say, 16?
3:10.
I'm sorry?
10.
3:10. 3:10, right. And I'm going to qualify this in a minute. Church, that's the storehouse. So when we determine how much God would have us to give, our primary beneficiary of that should be our local church. That doesn't mean at all that you cannot give above and beyond that. You may know of a ministry in a foreign country where there's starving children. It's fine. If you want to send something in for them, there's nothing wrong with that. But the first priority should be the church. And as a matter of fact, I might go so far as to say, if you have a ministry that you believe really deserves and could use some financial support, a good thing to do is to bring it up to the elders. And if the elders approve it, then the elder, then the church will be supporting this mission. That's the ideal way for it to happen. Okay? The next thing that some people have trouble with is found in 12, Romans. Romans 12. And in Romans 12, and verse 8, we learn something interesting. Paul is giving us a list of the gifts. And so, for example, teaching is a gift, is it? But does that mean if you don't have the gift of teaching, you should never teach? No. Anyone who's an elder should be able to teach. And we should be able, as more mature believers, to teach younger believers. So it's not necessary to have the gift in order to teach. It's just that those who do have that gift should be more prominent in their teaching ministry. Giving is also a gift. But of course, that doesn't mean that only believers with that gift should give. And as he lists the gifts of the Spirit, he says in Romans chapter 12, verse 8, he who exhorts in his exhortation, he who gives with liberality. So first of all, spelling it wrong. Anybody not know what liberality means? I'll give you the negative so you know. Don't open up the purse in your back pocket that when you open it up, a moth flies out and reach in there for a couple of coins. You're liberal in your giving. And you got to take all these together. You shouldn't take anyone alone. But also it says in Romans chapter 12, verse 8, he who gives with liberality, he who leads with diligence, he who shows mercy with cheerfulness. So you can see it's a continuation of the gift of the gifts of the Spirit. So that's Romans 12:1. Now you'll notice I'm not putting any numbers up here. I'm just giving you principles to go by. And if I sit down and do a calculation and determine how much I can give, add a little bit more to that. That's what that means. Give liberally. It doesn't mean to be foolish and give all your money away to the poor so that you're poor. God wants us to use wisdom. But it does mean we are to be liberal in our giving as opposed to miserly and complaining. Then, in 2 Corinthians 8, 1-8 is interesting. 2 Corinthians 8, 1-8. And we'll go over to 2 Corinthians 1, 8-8. Now notice what Paul says, and there's a very important word he's going to use here. See if you can spot it. Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God which has been given in the church of Macedonia. That grace of God was their willingness to give to the work. In a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. So you can see that they had a good, healthy attitude towards supporting the ministry. For I testify according to their ability, and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with so much urging for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. And this not as we expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. Okay, so one thing we can see here is that our giving should be generous. We should be generous givers. Now, again, I can't answer, I can't give you a pat answer on what's generous and then say, well, it's 12%. Because notice it also says here, in verse 3, they gave of their own accord. Do you see that? In verse 3. So if a preacher gets up and gives a sermon, a fiery sermon to his congregation, and says, if you're not giving 10%, you're out of the Lord's will. That's wrong. That's the law. It says here they gave of their own accord. In other words, it's a personal decision between God and myself. The only two people who really need to know how much I'm giving, well, there's three people out of necessity, me, God, and whoever the bookkeeper is obviously has to keep records. But we should give of our own accord, not because we're compelled to do it. If you sat down and you determined that based on your income and expenses, you could give, and somewhat sacrificially, 9%. We're not under the law, we're under grace. And you have the freedom in Messiah to decide with him how much you should give. Okay? Now, the next thing, just a couple more. Let me see one thing. Second Corinthians, I think that's 9:6-3. Let me make sure. Here's another principle. Now, this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Now notice he's not giving them a command. He's just stating a fact to them. And it's true. So in other words, what 2 Corinthians 9 and starting from verse 6 says, and there's one other point I want to make there. There's two points in here. Number one, we will reap what we sow. That's a universal rule. And number two, it also says in verse 7, very important, each one must do, now this is a command, but look what it says, just as he has purposed in his heart. not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. So it's a personal decision. Remembering that we reap what we sow. Okay, now that brings to mind the widow. You know the story of the widow's mite? The widow who can only give, she gave all she had to the Lord and was just like, in the temple, they used to have this hallway. And the hallway had these large metal, they looked like the lockers kind of in a gymnasium. Like they didn't have doors. Well, they did have doors, but they were locked. Couldn't get into them. And at the top, they had slots. And you know what the rich Pharisees used to do? They'd bring all their money, and there was no paper back there, and one by one, they wanted to make as much noise as they could. They wanted to make a clang and a clatter for everybody to see what they were doing. And then this poor woman comes, and she has one mite to give, but she gives it to God. She will sow more. She will reap more because of her generous, faithful giving than these Pharisees who did it for show. It's for God's work, not for show. Okay? And then one more. Let me sure. One, two, three, four. Yeah. Oh, you already did that one. That might be it. One. Oh, 2 Corinthians 8, 12 to 14. So let's see what it says in 2 Corinthians 8, 12 to 14. For if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. Paul doesn't expect us to mortgage our home to give a tithe. However, for this is not the case of others and for your affliction, but by way of equality. At this present time, your abundance being a supply for their need, so that their abundance may also become a supply for your need, that there may be equality. And what this is basically speaking about is that when we tithe, a good portion of our tithe, as I said, should go to the church. A good portion of our tithe should go to the needy. Now, the way that usually works out in a Bible-believing church, if they do it right, the elders have determined where the need lies. It may be a missionary organization that's having difficulty and struggling but doing the will of God. It may be a church member who just lost their job. And so it's primarily the church that does this. But again, that doesn't mean you can't either, because it's an act of love. Now you can see how much different this is than give a tenth. Give a tenth. But the word tithe has been used to represent how much we're supposed to give, and it's really not. Now, I'm not saying don't give 10%. That may be just what you're comfortable with. It fits your budget. In fact, there's a little sacrificial giving there. You're giving properly according to all the scriptures. God is pleased. One thing to remember that's very important is that we must provide for widows and orphans. I didn't get a scripture down for that, but it occurs to me, who are members of the church. The church should take care of its own. If you have someone in your church who lost his or her job and is falling on hard times, of course, depending upon the size of the church, that becomes important. The church should be proactive, because these things become known quite quickly. The church should become proactive in seeing to it that this family's church is met, so long as, and what's the so long as? The husband is willing to work. If he just wants to sit home and watch TV all day, that's not the way it works. But so long as the husband is willing to work, the church should pick up the slack.
What if the widow wants to sit and watch TV?
Primarily speaking, when they talk about widows in the Bible, generally speaking, and this is in the Old Testament too, whenever they're speaking in the Old Testament, and here Paul picks it up in the New Testament, when they're speaking about women, widows, and orphans, that's almost a metaphor for the needy. Now, I agree with you. It's possible there may be a widow who, let's put it this way. You know the company that makes M&Ms? That's headed up by a woman now, third or fourth generation. Certainly, she doesn't need money from her church. She's a multi-billionaire. She should be giving out of the abundance of what she gets. But what I'm saying is, in those cases, we use our discernment. If there's a widow, it's generally harder for widows to follow all these advisory rules than it is for a family that's prospering. Widows usually have it harder, because generally speaking, and this is true also today, but generally speaking, when you have a situation where a man passes away, it's not unusual that the woman has been a homekeeper for the last 25 years. And it would be very difficult for her now to start a new career at her stage in life. Plus, she has expenses. Now, of course, the church should evaluate these things on a case-by-case basis. If I go to the church, and there's nothing embarrassing about, well, it is a little embarrassing for us to do this, but if I go to the church and say that I've been put out of work and I'm in need of some financial help, and the church, I mean, these things are known. We all know these about different members of the church. We know that he's spending all of his time sitting on the couch eating potato chips, watching television. What we would admonish him to do is, you do your part and we will do our part. And when we see that he's diligently searching for work, then we help him. It does say in the Bible, if a man will not work, let him not eat. That's not including someone who's unemployed because they lost their job. It's including someone who's been laid off or just lost their job, like today. I used to volunteer in a soup kitchen, and this was very interesting. And it was more than a soup kitchen. They got a whole meal there, a whole dinner. And the food was excellent. And when I first started working there, the people who came in, you could tell, were the down and outers. You can look at them and tell. Men who were wearing the same pair of pants for 2 weeks. You can tell these people. But when the crash came, we began to see whole families coming in dressed well. Because maybe,
See, one of the pitfalls of being wealthy if you're not careful, let's suppose you just get married. And so generally speaking, you can just afford to get an apartment. Eventually, one day, you're able to buy a little house, you have some children, and let's suppose God really prospers you. And you get to the point where you're making $200,000 a year. And this happened, this is a true story. And all of a sudden, the company that you're... Now, during that period of time, by the time he was making whatever it was, let's say $200,000, his style of living went up, which is normal. He bought a bigger house, he got a nicer car, he did that, and of course he financed all this stuff. He lost his job, and because of that, he lost his house, and he lost his car, and he lost everything. So we do have to be wise with our spending. Now here's another little piece of wisdom about debt that I'll just give you, and then we'll close with that unless there's questions. There's a basic rule of thumb in giving to others. And this is not out of the Bible. My father told me this when I was a tot. He said to me, neither a borrower nor a lender be. Because if you lend money to a friend and he doesn't pay you back, you jeopardize the friendship. And it goes the other way around, too. It's better not to borrow or lend money. And so I said to my father, oh, what if you have a friend who really is in need? He said to me, give them some money with no expectation of return. If at some point in time they prosper and they decide they would like to repay you, all the better. But if not, once you give them that money, which was God's to begin with, it's now God's to work in that family. Okay? Questions? And again, the reason I brought... Go ahead.
I saw an ad yesterday for a t-shirt. It says, loan money to a pessimist. He doesn't expect to be paid back.
That's a good... You should teach a course, Pessimism 103. Yeah. Anyway, this is the New Teaching Testament, and you can see some differences between this and clearly the Old Testament. The Old Testament, there were no decisions to be made. Their tax structure was very specifically laid out. The word tithe is used. It means a tenth. But if you go through the Old Testament law and look at all the passages regarding different kinds of giving to be involved in, it comes out to 23%. That was basically their tax rate, you might say. In fact, in one case, and I can't remember what it was for, there was one particular thing that they were commanded to give a tithe of a tithe. What would a tithe of a tithe be? What do you think that would mean? 1%. And they were commanded, I can't remember what it was for, but there's something for which they had to give 1% of their earnings, one of the ministries in the temple. Okay? Any questions on the tithe? By the way, just one more thing about tithing before we go on. Tithing can become a source of dissension in the church. And it's best not to let the right hand know what the left is giving. And what that basically means is you should not advertise how much you give. If you're giving, if you're living a life of abundance and you have a lot, put your giving in the box. It's no longer your money. And it's God's money. And you should not boast about it. One other thing I want to mention before we move on, because I just remembered it. I have seen churches, and this usually happens in a small to medium-sized church, where there's a family that is extraordinarily wealthy, and let's say they give $5,000 a month to the church. They expect that their voice is going to be heard. They expect they're going to have the right to the pastor's office and say, this should happen and this should happen. We have to remember, once we take that money, and put it in that offering plate, it is no longer our money, and we have no say about what happens to it. It's God's money. We give, but we don't control. Okay? Questions?
That happened in church.
I'm sorry, a little later.
That thing happened in church.
I've seen it happen.
And
yeah, and it's hard sometimes because I once went to a small church that had maybe 50 members in it and was a family of about five. They were probably giving almost half the tithe, and the pastor was beside himself. He didn't know what to do. He said, I can't lose these people. I won't have a church. But I don't want to be them to be silent dictators either. So it can be difficult. You know, the Bible speaks more about money than it does about salvation. And so the reason for that is because money is such a problem for us. Think about this for a second, then we'll go on with Genesis. Just something to think about this. If your neighbor came over to you and said to you, listen, I'm baking a cake, and I just discovered I don't have any sugar. And I got to add the sugar now. I don't have time to go to the store. Could you lend me a cup of sugar? Most people wouldn't have a problem with that if they have it. Sure, take a cup of sugar. But what if somebody came over to your house and said, listen, I'm baking a cake and I forgot to get the sugar. Do you have $5 or $10 I can go and buy some sugar? Right away, money. For some reason, money has this thing about it that it's hard to let go of, you know? But we should always remember that everything we receive from God. It's His to begin with. And when we give it as an offering, we're just returning to God that which He lent us. And for us to try to control what's done with that money is to say to God, God, this month I gave X number of dollars to your work. Now here's what I think you should do with it. That's essentially what you're doing if you try to use it as a control ploy. Questions? It's not really that complicated. Yes?
In terms of the money being an offering, we were on a vacation in England at a Baptist church, and they put the collection bowl, big thing, out in the foyer. So you put your money in as you came into church. And then there, when it was time for church to start, they had this man who would hold the bowl up and just walk down the center aisle and place it on the meeting table in front. I just kind of like how that looked. You had more of a feeling of it being
obligation.
Well, an offering.
Yeah.
Because it was in this big thing, and
well, it can be comical because I was once in a church and one of my favorite kinds of churches to worship in is a black church. You want to get excited about the gospel, you go to a black church. And I'm serious about that. And I remember when I lived in Philadelphia, there was a neighborhood that was just townhouses, but it was an older neighborhood, and the people were somewhat poor. And churches couldn't afford buildings in this neighborhood. So what they used to do is they would buy little, you know, on the corner, there's sometimes a store. They would buy those little storefronts and turn them into little churches. And I remember one day I was driving down Market Street. This is where it is. I was driving down Market Street. And what this pastor had cleverly done, this was during the summertime. And, of course, none of them could afford air conditioners. So all the windows in the whole neighborhood were open to get some air. When it was time for him to give his sermon, right above the front door was a loudspeaker. If you were within five blocks of that church, you heard a sermon whether you wanted to or not. But anyway, what I'm getting towards is, in black churches, and you can, if you've had experience in black churches, this is generally true, the pastor is greatly looked up to and has a lot of authority. He has a lot of authority in the church. And
when I gave my, first of all, I love the music, you know, black spirituals, and I wish we would do that at our churches. It's such beautiful music and heartfelt music, music written by slaves looking for God to set them free, and set in within the gospel. But I went to speak in a church, and after I was finished speaking, the pastor passed the plate. And they brought it back up to the pastor, and he stood right there in Canada, and he goes, "What's this? This is all we have for Mr. Ellick, missionary, come speak to us. Close all the windows, lock all the doors." He did. And I'm passing this around again. And he passed it around again. And when it came back to him, he counted it. And he reached in his pocket, took out a $10 bill, threw it in, and he goes, "Now let's see what you can do. Don't embarrass me." And he did it twice. It was kind of comical. It was kind of comical. But he had the right idea. Those who make their living by the gospel should be recompensed for what they have done. And again, one of the most important things about tithing that God wants us to do is be a cheerful giver. You know where it says be a cheerful giver? You know what the Greek really translates? Hilarious. We should give with great joy, because God has blessed us, and it is more blessed to give than to receive. Okay, before we move on to Genesis, should I leave this now? Everybody okay? Does everybody understand it? How many of you want to follow it? Excuse me? How many of you think you can follow a scheme like that? I mean, it seems reasonable to me. If I were a pastor and a widow came into my church who was living on just welfare, I wouldn't expect her to give $200-$300 a month. But if a man came in who was the president of General Motors and he gave $300 a month, I'd say to myself, it's like he's not even giving. But of course, giving should be anonymous, and so I shouldn't even know that. It's none of my business. I'm the pastor, but I'm not the money canner. In fact, a wise pastor has no idea who's giving and has no how much it is, and none of the money passes through his hands, lest the devil take advantage. Okay, I think we've covered that enough. Let me see how we're doing time-wise. Oy, oy, oy. Open up your chapter, your Bibles to chapter 29 of Genesis. There we go. And in your notes, we'll be on 1:12, which is also chapter 29. Okay, everybody ready? Genesis chapter 29. First, let's read an introductory note from the notes. Chapters 29 and 30 display how God kept his promise and blessed Jacob abundantly. They also show how God disciplined the patriarch, Joseph, Jacob, in his process, in his, how the God disciplined the patriarch in the process. And one thing's for sure. Did you ever hear the question, the old saying, a barroom door opens both ways? If you push it open, doing something wrong, it's going to come swinging back at you. And that's the way life works. We reap what we sow. And as we're reading through this, and we see how the different people behave in this chapter, bring into mind how Jacob behaved with his brother and his parents.
And you'll see some real parallels here where Jacob got some of what he gave in a negative sense. Okay, Jacob meets Rachel. Chapter 29. And we'll start with verses 1 through 6. Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the sons of the east. He looked and saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. Apparently it was too large for them to move. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place in the mouth of the well. That was to protect the well from debris being thrown in it. Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." Now, who lives in Haran? Laban. Remember Eliezer went to Haran to ask Laban for Rachel's hand in marriage? Okay. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." And he said to them, "Is it well with him?" And they said, "It is well, and here is Rachel's daughter coming with the sheep." Okay, let's go over to the notes now. Jacob meets Rachel, verses 1 to 6. The structure and content of this passage reflect the significance of the Bethel experience. Jacob had been fleeing from Esau. Now he was looking for a bride. And of course, the thing that's going to change him here, he is going to change into his character is going to be affected, is he's going to have an encounter with God. And that's what changes us. He's going to have an encounter with God. And from God's perspective, Jacob was looking for a wife. But what was God's perspective? He wanted to carry on the seed of the covenant, because Jacob was to return to the land. He wasn't just to live there the rest of his life. This change in purpose was due to God's promise to him at Bethel. His quest was the fulfillment of that promise, namely the seed, while Jacob was outside the land. Now, just to review this real quickly, if we go to page 110, just so we can have it in front of us, 110 right at the top, and God's concern was this line of the seed carried on and the covenant be fulfilled. And look what it says in the chapter before, chapter 110. The point of the story is that wherever Jacob went, God was with him. This is symbolized by the ladder. Remember the ladder that went up to heaven and back down again? Explained in words by God and recognized in faith by Jacob. God reiterated to Jacob the covenant made with Abraham and Isaac, promising them a land, descendants as numerous as the dust, and universal blessings through him. That's the land, the seed, and the blessing. So he now inherits the blessings of the covenant. God also promised to protect and be with Jacob while he was out of the land and to see that he returned. So it was God's intention that Jacob return. Now we're going to see it's quite a few years before he returns, but he does return. Okay? Moreover, Jacob's spirit was now magnanimous and unselfish. He had a new outlook. His character was already starting to change because of these encounters with God. Significantly, Jacob's meeting of Rachel parallels his father's meeting of Rebekah, very similar, in chapter 24. Remember, both involved a well, Eliezer prayed, let her feed the, give the water to drink. And here it involves a well again. Wells pop up a lot in the Old Testament. So significantly, Jacob's meeting of Rachel parallels his father's meeting of Rebekah. Certainly, Laban, Rebekah's brother, would remember how God had led Eliezer. Yet this narrative, unlike 24, does not emphasize divine leadership, but it is implied. Do you know the book of Esther was almost included from the Bible? Does anybody know why? God's not mentioned in it. But they learned just because the word God is in it, you don't see his hand, and you clearly do. Okay? So Esther saw the invisible hand of God, and he opens doors and no man can close them, and he closes doors and no man can open them. Here was a man who received a marvelous vision. He knew God's plan to bless him and lead him. If that's all the knowledge you have in this world, that's all the knowledge you need. If you know what God's will is for your life and you follow it, you're walking on solid ground. So Jacob hastened on his mission. The literal Hebrew says, picked up his feet. He happened onto a spot where a well was located. It happened, notice that's in italics, because these things are not coincidental, to be here near Haran, where Laban lived, and Laban's daughter Rachel just happened to be in the be coming to the well. As I think we can see, there's more than just circumstance at work here. This timing was the work of the loving sovereign God who was leading all the way. The fact that the meeting took place at a well was also associated with God's blessing. And I have all this to scriptures you can read if you want. You know, out in the desert where these people live, a gallon of water could be more than a pound, worth more than a pound of gold. Because if you're out in the desert, all the gold in the world isn't going to save you when you die of thirst. If you have water, you can be saved until you get to the next town and maybe get another piece of gold. Who knows? Or maybe not, but at least you're alive. Okay, Jacob waters Laban's flocks. When Jacob watered Laban's flocks, remember Jacob is watering both his own flocks and Laban's, a note of anticipation was there. Subsequent chapters show how Laban and his flocks prospered in Jacob's presence. In contrast with Jacob's lazy shepherds, Jacob was generous, zealous, and industrious. He had a mission, a quest, that burning goal implanted by previous experiences drove him to succeed. And the application is here. We should seek wills God for us in terms of direction he wants us to go, and then permit that will to motivate us, and we will prosper. It says in Psalm 37:4 something very interesting that people often misinterpret. It says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Now, there are many believers who believe, Lord, I delight myself in you. Now, I could use a Cadillac. That's not what that means. It doesn't mean if you delight yourself in the Lord, he will give you what you want. It means if you delight yourself in the Lord, he will give you desires. He'll plant them in your heart for the gospel, for others, for your family, for your friends. And that will always be in accordance with God's will. Okay, here we go. Back to General Hospital. Laban's deception, verses 15 to 13. Then Laban said to Jacob, because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be? Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older daughter was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Now, when it says Leah's eyes were weak, that doesn't necessarily mean she didn't see well. The way they dressed back then, when women dressed, pretty much all you saw was their eyes. You've seen Muslims, women who dress like that. It wasn't to that extreme. But you can see a lot about a person just by looking in their eyes. So Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of face and form. Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Laban said, it's better that I give you to her than to give her to another man. Stay with me. Everything's fine so far. So Jacob served 7 years, and here's a significant statement for Rachel. And they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. Okay? Jacob's joyous prospect of marrying Rachel turned by Laban's deception into a nightmare. Wait, is that where I'm supposed to be? Yeah. I didn't read B, I don't think. Kissing of relatives, verses 1 and 13, 11 and 13, was a proper greeting. Have you ever seen people from the Middle East do that? They kiss the cheek and they kiss the cheek. That was part of their custom. In calling Jacob his own flesh and blood, Laban was probably adopting Jacob, his nephew, as a son, which was very significant in those days. Jacob's joyous prospect of marrying Rachel turned by Laban's deception into a nightmare. And Laban, Jacob met his match and also his means of discipline. Jacob had deceived his own brother and father and now was deceived by his own mother's brother. So God is using circumstances to correct and discipline Jacob. What he has sown, he is reaping. 20 years of drudgery, affliction, and deception lay ahead. Through Laban, he received his own medicine of duplicity. But Jacob's tenacity showed that he counted these as minor setbacks. God took him, developed his character, turned the fruits of his deception into blessing, and built the promised seed, the nation of Israel. Jacob's plan was to work 7 years to have Rachel as his wife. Now, he would get the wife at the beginning of the 7 years and then work off the 7 years. That's how it would work. Now, here's something that's very significant. Suppose that some young people come to you. They want to get married. He doesn't have a career yet. They haven't talked about children or how they're going to raise their children and anything like that. The parents haven't even met. But Jacob's tenacity shows that he counted these as minor setbacks. God took him, developed his character, turned the fruits of his deceptions into blessing, and built the promised seed, the nation of Israel. Jacob's plan was to work 7 years to have Rachel as his wife. Those seven years passed quickly for Jacob because of his love for her. And it's a basic rule of thumb, especially amongst young people. Lust can never wait. Love can always wait. And that's wise counsel to give young people. If you get married because of a physical attraction, you're on shaky ground right at the start. And there's an old saying, you should date around the seasons before you even start thinking about marriage. That's for 1 year, around the seasons. When the time came for the wedding feast, hearts were merry and spirits were high. But in the night, Leah, Rachel's older sister, was substituted. This was a masterpiece of shameless treachery. Unloved Leah given to the man in love with Rachel. Boy, oh boy, did Jacob reap what he sowed. Jacob's anger was to no avail. Now, as the object of trickery, he would understand how Esau felt. Because this is just, he did the same thing to Esau. Details a little different, but he was getting a mirror image of himself. In fact, Laban was more of a con man than Jacob. Laban offered a technicality of a local custom. It is not right to marry the younger before the older. Now, it says in the Bible in Psalm 15:4, a wise man swears to his own hurt. So if you promise somebody something, God expects you to deliver that promise. Even if late, let's say I promise you something and I expect to profit from it. I learn later I'm not going to profit from it. I'll swear to my own hurt. I'll keep my promise. That's the way it should be. And God's very displeased when we don't do that. That's not quite the same as making a vow. It's letting your yes be yes and your no be no. Those words must have pierced Jacob. In his earlier days, the younger had deceptively pretended before his father to be the older brother. If social customs were to be set aside, it should be by God and not by deception. Let God do God's work. Laban's stinging words were left without any comment. The event was simply God's decree against Jacob. So we can see what's happening here. Jacob is having a humbling experience. And I'm sure he wasn't ignorant of what was going on. He was a smart man. The Bible demonstrates over and over again the principle that what a man sows, he reaps. Galatians 6:7. Some have called this irony poetic justice. But it is more than that. It is divine retribution in which there is often a measure for a measure turn of affairs. A measure for a measure turn of affairs. And you'll notice something. Did you ever read in the Old Testament where it says, was given double for all his sins? That phrase. Or he will be given double for all his sins. Sometimes a man has to give double for like stealing a cow. That doesn't mean he has to give twice as much. For example, God at one point says, tell Israel her warfare is ended. She has received double for all her sins. It doesn't mean Israel receives twice as much discipline as the sins that she committed. What it means is this. If you have two twins, they're doubles, right? Double for double means the same for the same. To be double, to be repaid double for all your sins, is that the payment is the double of the original sin. It's a little awkward in its English translation, but that's, in the English we would say, let him receive, let him reap exactly what he sowed. And those are the two doubles. Okay. Give you an example of that. You know where it says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? People think that's double, but that's not what that means. All that's saying in figurative language is the crime should fit the punishment. That's really all that it's saying. With Jacob, this deception was perfectly fitted. It was divine. I don't like the word punishment. It should be discipline. Believers are not punished, they're disciplined. There's a very big difference. Discipline has as its end an improved character and an improved walk with God. Punishment is just retribution. To bring his own craftiness before his eyes. He had deceptively presented himself to his father under the guise of the firstborn. Now Leah, the firstborn, was deceptively under the guise of Rachel, the younger. So God orchestrated through the affairs of man this lesson, this discipline for Jacob. Each daughter was given a servant girl as a wedding gift, a custom common in that society. Leah was given Zilpah, and Rachel received Bilhah. Jacob worked another 7 years, which he owed Laban in return for Rachel. Okay, I think what we're going to do is make this our end point in the notes, because the next section really can't be divided up. It has to be taken as a whole when it's long. I know I took up... Turn this off. Wait a minute, just do this.